Sandra, you're here to give a lecture entitled Contaminated Without Consent, and it's part of the Memorial Rachel Carson lecture. Just wondering what kind of inspiration she was to you.
Well, Rachel Carson really planted the field in which I labor, and so I consider her a kind of patron saint, if you would. Carson and I have several things in common. Both of us, when we were in college, struggled to decide whether to study biology or English and poetry, and both of us decided to study biology because it would give us something to write about later on. And of course, both of us did go on to become authors of books that are about science and biology and ecology in particular. And also both of us had cancer. Carson unfortunately died 18 months after Silent Spring was published. And I think the silencing of her pen and her voice is an incredible loss for the world, because she was only in her mid-50s and presumably would have had many more years and many more books to follow. I was diagnosed much younger than she. I was 20 years old and diagnosed with bladder cancer in between my sophomore and junior years in college. I think one of the important differences between Carson's life and mine is that she lived in incredible fear that her cancer diagnosis would be uncovered and used by her enemies in industry as a weapon to discredit her scientific objectivity. Whereas I think all the years of feminism that happened in between Carson's life and mine allowed me to talk about more openly about my life as a cancer survivor, and even in some cases blend that story with some of my science in a way that has not been the focus of the kind of scorn and ridicule that Carson feared for herself. But Carson, I guess in a larger way, gave us this idea that we all have the right to know about toxic chemicals that others are putting into our environment, precisely because they are public gestures. You cannot hide behind proprietary laws and trade secrets when the chemicals you're using enter the environment that we all share and then enter into our own bodies. And Carson also argued that with the right to know comes the obligation to act. And I think that obligation is what I perceive very acutely in the work that I do as a scientist and a writer.
The lecture that you're giving in London is on International Day of No Pesticides, which is actually the anniversary of the Bhopal disaster. Do you remember hearing news of that event, and what was your reaction to that?
I remember Bhopal very keenly. I was in graduate school at the time, and the story just kept unfolding in a kind of awful way, with the numbers of the dead and wounded rising and rising and rising as the acute deaths then were followed by other people who had been mortally injured who but took longer to die, and those then in turn were followed by other waves of people who would die years later from some of the chronic effects of that exposure. And I also remember very keenly the frustration that those first on the scene felt, because there were no requirements that the pesticide factory release the chemical, the name of the chemical that everyone had been exposed to, that so the physicians didn't even know what the poison was or how to treat it. And I think this unknowing was precisely what became the trigger for the U.S. passage of the Right to Know laws in 2 years later, in 1986, and passed by only one vote in Congress. The idea that when chemicals are released into the environment and people are exposed, we have the right to know what those chemicals are. It seems like such a common sense notion then, but until Bhopal, I think that right to know idea was not part of common knowledge and common understanding.
We've mentioned Rachel Carson, but when did you first become passionate about the environment?
Well, Rachel Carson's book Silent Spring was published before I even started school. My father was a high school teacher of consumer education and business and economics, and he used that book as a textbook and for his students. And so I remember the book sitting around the house when I was a little girl, and I remember also that everyone was talking about it. It wasn't just people like my parents who were school teachers. It was, you know, the bus driver, and it was just a book that seemed to capture everyone's imagination. And of course, children are very perceptive about things that are changing the minds of adults. And so I certainly was very interested in how it was that a book could change the world. I certainly didn't read it until much later, but my dad got us all involved in growing organic tomatoes and selling them by the side of the road. And so I think I was introduced to the ideas very, very early, you know, even before I could read, just because my father tried to put some of her recommendations in place. So one of my earliest memories actually is my dad ordering ladybugs by mail and having them arrive in the package, and you open it up and here are all these ladybugs that he was going to release into our garden to serve as natural predators. You know, things like that don't usually arrive by post, so that was very exciting as a little girl to see that happen too. So I think it was, you know, that experience, having had a mother who was also a biologist, who bought me a microscope when I was 9 years old, you know, all these, you know, I was looking at pond water under the microscope before I was even out of grade school. I think these were all influential in my life.
The subtitle of your lecture here is Why Our Exposure to Chemicals in Air, Food and Water Violates Human Rights. Which human rights exactly are being violated?
Well, what I'd like to do tonight is lay out the new scientific evidence that demonstrates that trace amounts of exposure to toxic chemicals, in fact, affect different people differently, not only because we're born into this world with different genetic constitutions, but because all of us enter and leave during our lifetimes periods of time that toxicologists call windows of vulnerability, during which time we're exquisitely sensitive to the effects of toxic chemicals in amounts disproportionate, and the effects are disproportionate to the dose. And one of those times, of course, is during pregnancy and in infancy. And another one appears to be during adolescence, and another is in old age. So during these windows of time, we, for various reasons, are not as able to defend ourselves against toxic chemicals as we are in other times of our life. So what I am going to try to argue after I lay the science out is that we're not actually offering equal protection under the law. We are, in fact, engaging in a form of age discrimination, certainly against the elderly and the very young, and very possibly against teenagers as well, simply because we are regulating toxic chemicals with middle-aged adults in mind, not with special populations with special vulnerabilities in mind. For example, all of us older than 6 months have something called a blood-brain barrier that actually works pretty well to keep toxic chemicals such as insecticides that might be cycling around in our bloodstream from entering the gray matter of our brain. But we don't develop a blood-brain barrier until we're 6 months old. So for everyone younger than that age, tiny, tiny exposures to insecticides have disproportionate effects because the very young are missing this entire suit of armor that surrounds the rest of our brains and helps protect them. And then again, at the end of life, the blood-brain barrier starts to become more permeable yet again. So the elderly are also another vulnerable population. So I think that the basic human right is the right to live in a safe environment and the right to not be subjected to bodily harm.
You mentioned pregnancy there, and you've written a book called Having Faith, An Ecologist's Journey to Motherhood. Indeed, one of your children is called Faith. What were your thoughts and concerns during your pregnancy?
Well, by the time I became pregnant, I was on the brink of 40, and I had already spent 20 adult years as a biologist looking at organisms and the habitats that they live in. So my first thought upon learning I was pregnant was, oh my God, I am now a habitat, you know. And so I really turned my scientist's eye inward and became interested in looking at the environment of the pregnant uterus. And just as I've looked at the way toxic chemicals flow through other environments and create unintended consequences and changes in those environments, I became really interested in taking a look at the environment of pregnancy and asking what are the effects of tiny exposures in an environment in which a human body is just being assembled. So I spent then 4 years at Cornell University studying a field called fetal toxicology, and then blended the results of that research with the memoir of my own joyful pregnancy and birth and breastfeeding relationship with my daughter.
And what you were writing about was a month-to-month account of your experiences during your pregnancy as well.
Pregnancy, of course, orders itself. It has its own narrative flow with the sort of the long suspense that builds up in the first 9 months, and then the big climax of labor and delivery, and then the sort of denouement of the breastfeeding relationship. So I really allowed the biological events of pregnancy as they unfold in chronological order to structure the book. So the book is ordered, you know, with 9 chapters, each for one month of pregnancy, and then 3 chapters to cover each of the 3 years of my breastfeeding relationship with Faith. And within each chapter, then, the major embryological events that are occurring during that month are explicated, as well as in discussion of all the environmental threats that come into the picture at that particular point in time. And then there's a lot of autobiography about what I was experiencing as a pregnant mother, how this felt to me. You know, when, for example, I underwent an amniocentesis and 30 cc's of amniotic fluid were removed from my pregnant uterus to be tested for Down syndrome, which is a kind of ritual that in the U.S. I think certainly most older pregnant women undergo, and I certainly did. And I was able to actually hold that amniotic fluid in my own hands, and it appeared to me very beautiful. And at the same time, I was doing research on the presence of pesticides, dioxins, and PCBs in human amniotic fluid and what it might mean for human development. So the book really juxtaposes the toxicology with the actual sort of a personal account of what's going on during each month of pregnancy.
And one of the things that you also seem to have strong views about is breast milk.
I do, and I felt like the breastfeeding chapters were a kind of high wire act that I was walking, because I wanted to begin a public conversation about breast milk contamination, and I wanted to do it from a very pro-breastfeeding perspective. And that's a tricky thing to do, because it's hard, I think, to hold two seemingly contradictory truths in one's head at the same time. And one true thing about breast milk is it's absolutely the best food for human infants. There is no substitute for it. All the data are really clear that infants who are breastfed go on to not only to suffer from less illness and death as infants, but then enjoy benefits possibly for a lifetime. And so, for example, breastfed infants develop into children and then adults who are at lower risk for diabetes, obesity, rheumatoid arthritis, Crohn's disease, allergies, asthma, eczema. So all kinds of autoimmune problems are safeguarded when one is, you avoid all kinds of autoimmune problems when one is breastfed. And breastfed children have higher IQ and better visual acuity and better hearing, because there are growth factors present in breast milk whose job it is to help guide the neurons in the brain to find their right connections. So there just is no substitute for any of that. On the other hand, the other true thing about breast milk is it's become the most chemically contaminated food on the planet, human food. So, and that's because breast milk exists one rung higher on the human food chain than the food that we adults eat, so that these bioaccumulative contaminants that we worry about have one more chance to concentrate in their sort of poisonous properties when in the back of a woman's chest wall, so that breast milk has, you know, for example, 10 to 100 times more dioxins, more PCBs, more flame retardants, more toilet deodorizers, more gasoline vapors, more moth-proofing agents. You know, all of these things contaminate all of our foods, but at much lower levels, and they reach higher levels in breast milk. Historically, we have not considered the nursing infant when we have set so-called safe limits of exposure to chemical toxicants in food. So what may be safe for you and me as an adult may not be safe for a nursing infant, not only because they're missing a blood-brain barrier, but because they're just getting more of that poison on a pound-for-pound body weight basis than we adults are, because these chemicals are higher in concentration than in mother's milk than they are in cow's milk or in wheat or corn or eggs or fish or all the other foods that we might eat. So I think what this has to mean, these two true things about breast milk, that it's the best food on the one hand and it's also the most contaminated food on the other, it means, first of all, that right now our nursing infants are paying a terrible price for their right to be fed mother's milk and for the good health that they enjoy from their mother's milk. And therefore, the right answer, I think, has to be not to go back to infant formula, which is a very inferior pretender to mother's milk, but rather to immediately move to divorce our economy from its dependence on any chemical that A, is known to be toxic, and B, is known to accumulate in breast milk. So I think it should be a national and indeed an international priority to take a look at all the chemicals that contaminate mother's milk worldwide right now and immediately move to find non-toxic substitutes for each and every one of them. That campaign, that initiative won't happen unless mothers themselves and those who represent mothers, such as the pediatric community, the midwifery community, the lactation community, speak out, because nursing infants can't speak out for themselves. So we need to advocate on their behalf, and we need to advocate on behalf of clean, chemically free mother's milk. We won't do that if we all turn away from the contamination issue out of fear that women will go back to formula if we even dare raise the issue. But in fact, the need to be quiet about breast milk contamination so that women continue to breastfeed is a very powerful force, at least in the United States right now. And it's something I worried a lot about, because I certainly didn't want to wake up in the morning and see a headline in the newspaper like, you know, Cornell prof says poison in mother's milk, and a pregnant woman read that and not read any further and simply decide not to breastfeed on because of that. So it's often hard to be in control of one's own message once it goes out into the media, but I try very hard to talk about breastfeeding contamination from a breastfeeding perspective. And for that reason, I took my then very infant son, Elijah, with me on my book tour and actually openly breastfed him during media interviews and in press conferences, as I'm doing right now, to make sure that the message about breast milk contamination not only came from a scientist who spent 2 years looking at many thousands of studies, but also came from a nursing mother herself. So that way I felt that the message couldn't be misunderstood as an anti-breastfeeding message.
I'd like to ask you about the effect your illness had upon you, and whether when finding links between cancer and the environment, whether that was actually difficult to prove.
Well, I'm a sample size of only one, and so the fact that I had bladder cancer, which is a cancer with a lot of links that go back a long way between environmental exposure and the risk for that disease, the fact that my own hometown drinking water wells are contaminated with perchloroethylene, which is a solvent with suspected links to bladder cancer, that was of profound interest to me, but I've never made the claim that my bladder cancer was caused by this or that exposure. I was more interested in letting my own experience with cancer drive my curiosity. And so as a PhD biologist then in my mid-30s, some 15 years after my own diagnosis, I went back to my hometown and became a kind of environmental detective there and researched the alleged cancer cluster that existed there, researched the toxic releases that were available to me under the Right to Know laws. And so I was interested in the whole larger story of what happened to my community and all the people in it, not just asking that question, why me, that was very specific just to myself. So I think that the conclusions that I reach at the end of that book, Living Downstream, were that a lot of us are being exposed to toxic chemicals needlessly and without our consent, because safer alternatives exist for so many of them. What we need now is the political will and the economic creativity to transform our society from its current dependency on these chemicals toward a more toxic-free society. And the example of the perchloroethylene in drinking water, I think, is probably a good one, because 80% of the use of this solvent is used in the dry cleaning industry. And yet the technology exists to wet clean clothes in such a way that we don't need to use this solvent. We can use plain old-fashioned soap and water again to clean things like silks and wools. Now, this also requires special training and computerized washing machines and things like that, and special detergents. But the technology and the know-how exists. So the trick becomes, how do we help capitalize that transformation so that mom-and-pop dry cleaning establishments still owned by small families can invest in the new technology? The problem isn't that we don't know how to, our dilemma is not that we have to go back to beating our clothes against rocks to get them clean or dry clean them. You know, I think that's people's fear, that somehow if we phase these things out, we're going to be going back in time. What we're talking about is going forward in time to a better technology that we've already invented, that we know works, but that's going to require some upfront money to help people learn how to use it. And that will only happen when the citizenry knows about the dangers of the old technology and demand that the new technology start taking its place. And that's what I'm interested in, trying to serve as a catalyst for change by presenting the biological argument and leave the economic transformation to those to the economists and to the policymakers and to those who really know how to make these things happen.
You seem to be intimating that we need to get active about these issues, though, and I wonder what your main advice about that would be.
I think that the what to do question is one that everyone has to ask in their own heart and come to the answer. There is no one right thing to do. There is no even one most important thing to do. It's true that we have to save the world, and right now I think the natural systems of the world, which are our life support system, are in trouble. But saving the world is a collective effort. It's not on any one of our shoulders to do that. So what I like to tell my audience and my readers is that it's as though we're all required together as the human race to play the Save the World Symphony. And each of us is a musician in that orchestra, and we just need to find out what instrument we're playing and play it very well. So that, for example, I am interested in having a conversation with the fashion design community about the role of dry cleaning and the way in which cotton might be grown less destructively. Right now, cotton is one of the most environmentally destructive crops that we grow. I'm interested in talking with professional athletes about the use of pesticides in athletic fields. Particularly, I've been working with professional golfers on the issue of pesticides in golf courses. I'm interested in talking with farmers about breaking their dependency on chemicals and going in more organic directions. My husband is a sculptor, and so I'm interested in having a conversation with the art community on art materials that might be more safer, not only for themselves, but that are also safer for the workers who produce them and safer for the environment at the end of their life. I've worked with architects and builders and firefighters over the issue of toxic chemicals in building materials. I've worked with the lactation community and physicians and healthcare community on environmental issues facing children, the use of arsenic and pressure-treated wood that is used to build children's playground equipment, etc. So it seems to me everyone has some link to the environment, whether they're a gardener or an artist, or they work in industry or in agriculture or in the government. And so whatever that connection is, people are all experts on something, and they just need to figure out what they can do within the framework that they're already in. And if we all did that together, we could effect powerful change. And I think whenever people wed an environmental concern to a passion of theirs, then they're in it for the long term. If you try to get people to change their whole life, you know, work on transportation issues and work on energy issues and work on the dry cleaning issues and buy organic food, it's too much for people and they feel overwhelmed. But I think just working on one little piece of it and working on it together with your peers and with people who are also in the field that you're in can be a really rewarding thing.
With some of the things that you've mentioned, I mean, there's been phenomenal changes even since Rachel Carson's time in the 60s. Do you despair that her message hasn't been heeded?
Well, I don't have a lot of room for despair. I think despair is a luxury we can't afford, and it's a big waste of time. I think that the fact that Carson died 18 months after Silent Spring was published is part of the reason that more change didn't happen more quickly after that book was released. On the other hand, she's given us an incredible guidebook for how to go forward, and we just need to take action on it. And I think despair is probably the biggest obstacle we face, because if people feel defeated before they even start to fight, then we've already lost. Industry is a powerful foe in sometimes, because they get very stubborn about wanting to continue to do what they're doing. And yet, if all of us together insisted that change happen, it does happen. I mean, we did get rid of slavery. Women did win the right to vote. We did get children out of factories. And none of these things happened without incredible struggle and with incredibly long struggles. But those who started the struggle, who were seen as these wild-eyed idealists, you know, probably didn't live to see the day that their dreams were realized, but they were realized. The banner was just picked up by other people. And I think the fight for environmental human rights, which is the human rights struggle of this century, will eventually be won. And I think I'd like to imagine that my children or their children will look back on this turn of the century time that we're now in and say, you know, how did people live with cancer-causing chemicals being spewed at them from the backs of cars, and you know, they had to purchase all these toxics just to paint their houses and put carpeting on the floors and buy their food, and what were they thinking, you know? And perhaps in the same way that we look back now and say, how could they grow cotton with the use of slave labor? What were they thinking back then? I mean, I think there'll be better times ahead. And I don't think that's going to just inevitably happen. It won't happen without a big mass human rights movement, but I certainly think it's possible and probable, and I want to be part of it. So and not let Rachel Carson's voice be a voice simply shouting in the wind. You know, I think her message needs to be picked up and carried forward on not just by me, but by all kinds of other folks who are out there.
Sandra, thank you very much for talking to me.